Really nice to be here. I actually grew up in Glen Ellyn, so this is, you know, back in my old neighborhood, and it feels really good driving down Roosevelt Road. I'll tell you something. When I was growing up here about 20 years ago, there was literally one burrito joint within like 20 square miles, and now there are like nine on the stretch of Roosevelt Road that I drove down, which means that there's been progress, serious progress. But I'm happy to be here for many reasons. One is because, as Tim said, the Theosophical Society brought into the world 138 years ago a new and old idea, which is that different religious traditions all have great spiritual wisdom, and that we can and ought to learn from those traditions. And I want to thank you for the work that you personally do, all the staff and organizers here do, and for the work with Gandhi, however many decades ago, the work with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The Theosophical Society has long been on the vanguard of those types of movements and partnerships, and that is no small thing. I also want to thank you for carving out a really beautiful space in the western suburbs of Chicago, a space that you can kind of, you feel its positive energy from some blocks away. And that is, you know, there's one thing to be celestial, and there's another thing to be very concrete. And there's something very beautiful about this space that you have created. And again, that I think that's a reflection of the spiritual ethos of the Theosophical Society. So the talk that I want to do today is really the themes of my book, Sacred Ground, Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America. And I want to tell you where the idea and the title of the book come from. So what's it, 3 years ago this summer, in the summer of 2010, America was embroiled in the Ground Zero Mosque madness, if people remember that, right? Could this Muslim community, led by Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, establish a Muslim community center, effectively a Muslim YMCA, a couple of blocks from where Imam Rauf had his mosque for about 20 years? And you couldn't get this story off of your television. You couldn't get it off. You had to be hiding under a rock to not come in touch with this story in the summer of 2010. And it's a story that dug deep into my heart for a variety of reasons. One is that I've known Imam Faisal for about 10 years, and he's about the gentlest man that one could meet. In fact, one of my colleagues at Interfaith Youth Corps says that his voice makes her want to do yoga. So I knew that would go over well with this audience. Seeing him looped on TV as a radical imam starting a terrorist command center, I thought that I'd gone through the looking glass. And I was doing a lot of media at the time, and I remember being on CNN at one point, and the CNN anchor says, you know, can't you just move this 10 blocks, 20 blocks, 30 blocks away? I mean, don't you understand that part of America, that part of New York City is sacred ground? And I gave my 2 cent response to that, and it wasn't very smart, and I did it with some anger in my being, and it didn't go over very well. But walking off that stage, I had this insight that I believe 20 blocks away from Ground Zero is also sacred ground, and I believe that 200 miles north is sacred ground, and 1,000 miles south, and 3,000 miles west. I believe that all of America is sacred ground, and we can have a conversation about the whole planet being sacred and the whole universe being sacred. And I believe those things as well. But I believe that there is something genuinely distinctive about the American project. And that's that we started as a nation with the idea that people from different backgrounds could come here and contribute, and that we would nurture cooperation between them. And that's a sacred project, right? That's a holy project. And I wonder why, in that entire summer, nobody ever said in public, all of America is sacred ground. Because any nation, any entity which says, come, bring your particular identities, bring your Wheaton colleges and your Theosophical societies, plant them in the soil of this nation, let them give rise to institutions that serve the public good. That's remarkable. And so I began to write a book based on the idea of what if we considered the American project a sacred project, particularly the dimension of that project, which orients around the value of pluralism. So that's the subject of my talk tonight. I want to begin by defining what I mean by pluralism. And I want to say that this is a civic definition of pluralism. There are metaphysical definitions of pluralism. There are spiritualist definitions of pluralism. This is what I would call a civic definition of pluralism. In other words, what does it mean for people from different backgrounds to live together in the same society? That's the question that I try to answer in my work and that we try to answer at Interfaith Youth Core. For us, pluralism has three parts. Respect for the identities of different communities. Part two is positive relationships between those communities. And part three is a commitment to the common good. In other words, you're not just committed to the well-being of your own community, whether you're a Muslim or a Jew or a Jain or an atheist. You're committed to broader principles of a nation that if those principles are upheld, there is the sense that all communities within the nation will flourish. So that's our definition of pluralism, right? The question we're trying to answer is, what does it mean to have a nation where people from different backgrounds live together? How do you have them thrive instead of be at each other's throats? And we think the answer to that is the building of pluralism, respect between different communities, relationships between them, and a commitment to the common good. Let me say that this is both a civic and a sacred project. What do I mean by civic project, right? Well, if we think about the United States, we think about all of these institutions started by different communities, whether it's the NAACP started by African Americans, or whether it's Wheaton College started by evangelicals, or whether it's Notre Dame University started by Catholics. If those institutions only serve their own community, right, became what some sociologists call bonded social capital, you basically have a nation of people from different backgrounds who live in their own bubbles. And that's a situation where you can easily cultivate animosity towards people from different backgrounds. That's dangerous. You know what that is? That's Iraq right now. That's Afghanistan right now. It's a nation where people from different backgrounds build their own little societies and say, we don't want to live with those other people. The civic project of pluralism is doing what sociologists call bridging social capital. These different communities building their institutions, their theosophical societies, their Notre Dames, their Wheaton Colleges, their Sweden Covenant Hospitals, but those institutions are in cooperation with each other. They're bridging their social capital. Bonded social capital is positive to an extent, but can be dangerous because it can quickly turn into a tribal conflict situation. Bridged social capital is what a diverse society needs. That's the civic project of pluralism, right? Here's the sacred part of that. There's this beautiful line in the Quran that God made us different nations and tribes that we may come to know one another. And that sentiment is reflected in tradition after tradition after tradition, that the idea of relationships between people who are different is a holy idea. It's, again, something that's deep in the wisdom of the Theosophical Society. So I'll give you a couple of examples from different religions on this. The great Rabbi Hillel from Judaism: if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? If I'm only for myself, then what am I? You know, this notion, again, deep in the wisdom of the Jewish sages, that there is something holy about being for other people. I think about that in the example of the great 20th century Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel marching together with Martin Luther King Jr. in Selma, saying it felt like our legs were praying. You know, here's an Eastern European Orthodox Jew who sees his people burned in the fires of Hitler's Europe in World War II, who comes to the United States and joins the civil rights movement, recognizes that there is something in Jewish wisdom and ethics that is at stake in a different people's struggle. That's the sacred project of pluralism, right? So pluralism is both a civic project. You need it to have a decent and healthy civil society, but it is also a sacred project. Again, I think this notion that humanity is a single family and we treat each other in a way that's respectful, that's relational, that's cooperative. In the American project, right, in this experiment as a nation, in this book, I tease out what I call four pillars of American pluralism. I want to walk through those pillars very quickly. And the first is what I would call the vision of the founders, right? Let's just own how imperfect our founders were. Right? Let's own their imperfections around racism, around gender issues. We know those imperfections. And still, George Washington wrote that the bosom of America would be open to the refugees of all nations and religions. Benjamin Franklin helped to build a hall in Philadelphia and said, the pulpit of this hall should be open to any preacher, including a Muslim from Constantinople. If the Grand Mufti of Constantinople wants to send a preacher to us, this pulpit will be at his service. James Madison said through Voltaire, that if there's one religion in a country, it does what one religion always does. It smashes everybody else. If there's two religions, they do what two religions usually do, which is that they kill each other. In America, and this is the late 18th century, right, 200 some odd years ago, there are 30 religions, he said. So we have to learn how to get along. When my friend Keith Ellison got elected to Congress, the first Muslim ever to be elected in U.S. history, African-American Muslim from the 5th District in Minnesota, there was somebody out in Virginia who said that letting Keith Ellison take his oath of office on the Holy Quran, which is what he requested to do as a Muslim, would open up the doors of America to the Muslim hordes from all over the world who would all rush Capitol Hill demanding Qurans. That's true, by the way. That's not a caricature. So Keith Ellison reminded this gentleman, first of all, that he wasn't an immigrant, that his people had been in this country for many hundreds of years. He's an African-American, the descendant of slaves ripped off the coast of West Africa in the founding of America. And then he did something that was so noble and profound. He walked across the street to the Library of Congress, and he went to the Rare Books Library, and he requested to check out the Quran owned by Thomas Jefferson. And he took his oath of office on that Quran. And what was he doing? He was reminding Americans that at the founding of our nation, one of our founding fathers, the author of the Declaration of Independence, had reverently owned a Quran. The vision of the founders, I believe, is one of the pillars of pluralism in America. One of my favorite stories about this is George Washington in 1791. He receives a message from a Jewish leader named Moses Cetius. And Cetius is well aware of what's happened to Jews, especially in Europe, for hundreds of years. They've been hounded and hated and harassed. And so Cetius sends Washington a message and says, what's going to happen to my people in this new nation? What will become of us Jews? He was the head of this little synagogue, the Touro Synagogue in Rhode Island, late 18th century. Washington meditates on the message for a while, and he sends back a letter with these words, "This government will give bigotry no sanction and persecution no assistance." How beautiful is that in 1790, a declaration from the first president, not a particularly religious man himself, incidentally, telling a Jewish leader that he has nothing to fear in America. He says in that letter that the children of the stock of Abraham should be able to sit in safety under their own vine and fig. They should comport themselves as good citizens. There shall be none to make them afraid. He ends that letter with this line, which is the epigraph of my book, Sacred Ground. May the Lord of all mercies scatter light and not darkness, and make all of us useful in our own ways and happy in his everlasting way. Such a beautiful line. Again, 1790, first president of the United States, pillar of this nation from the very beginning, pillar of pluralism. Pillar number two, the African-American response to marginalization. So one of my favorite pieces of writing by George Washington is to the person who runs his grounds, Mount Vernon. And he says to them, that the workmen, the people who come to work on Mount Vernon, he doesn't care if they're Jews or Muslims or Quakers or Christians or atheists, as long as they can do the work, right? And whoever came to work on Mount Vernon worked next to Washington's slaves. Because like Jefferson, like others of our founding fathers, Washington was a slave owner. It is the original sin at the heart of the American experiment. There's just no getting around it. You know, as Malcolm X famously said, we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. And my dad tells me this story. Not long after September 11th, he was at an event of a Muslim activist organization. Mazur might have been there at that same event. The organizer of the event got up and pounded his fist on the podium and said, "We are about to witness an erosion of civil liberties for Muslims in America." You know, and he basically articulated this vision, some of which came true, of a set of prejudice and legal challenges that Muslims would face. And he pounded his fist and he said, "We need a Muslim civil rights movement." And the chief guest at that event was Jesse Jackson. And the organizers prevailed on Reverend Jackson to speak, and Reverend Jackson spoke. And he got up there, and he said, first line, "There's no such thing as a Muslim civil rights movement. There are civil rights. And you have a choice. Are you going to put your shoulder to the wheel of a general principle of U.S. democracy, or are you only going to carp about your own community?" It says, when people who looked like me, African Americans, fought and bled and died in the streets of this country so that people who looked like you could come here and drink from the same water fountains and swim in the same swimming pools and go to the same public schools, we weren't saying that it was just a problem when we got sent to the back of the bus. We were saying it was a problem when anybody got sent to the back of the bus. So don't talk about Muslim civil rights. Talk about civil rights and commit yourself to working for those for everybody. Profound, profound piece of wisdom, right? And where does Jesse Jackson learn that? At the feet of the person that he walked next to for many years, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. King would talk about the American dream, not just the African-American dream. In this beautiful presentation at Lincoln University, he talks about the American dream as a dream where people of all creeds and colors could come to a country and live together. King would quote Langston Hughes, "Oh yes, I say it plain, America never was America to me, and yet I swear this truth, America will be." How powerful is that, right? That the community of people who were marginalized, left out of the American project, decided that America wasn't a lie. It was a broken promise. And they were going to work to help fix it. And I believe that this idea of an American project, I believe that the glow of the American promise would have been broken in two had not African Americans, particularly during the Civil Rights Movement, made that decision. Easily stood have stood up and said, how can you write this in your documents and do this in your reality? Instead, this community stood up and said, all right, we're going to work to make this better. And a big part of the lesson of that is every other community that feels marginalized, whether it's Muslims or Latinos or the LGBT community or Japanese, looks at that example and says, you know what? We're not going to call it a lie. We're going to work to help improve it. Second pillar of pluralism in America, the African-American response to their subjugation and marginalization. Third pillar of pluralism in America, particular communities create institutions that serve the public good. I'm in this country because Notre Dame University, a school started in 1842 in the little town of South Bend, Indiana, by a group of French Catholics of the Holy Cross Order, let in a somewhat wayward Indian Muslim student to their MBA program in the 1970s. That man is my father. He did enough work to get through that MBA program and developed a fierce devotion to fighting Irish football in the process, which is what I think he really studied. But think about this for a second. why did a school started by French Catholics of the Holy Cross Order need to let in an Indian Muslim immigrant? Not for the tuition dollars. There are plenty of Catholics lining up to go to Notre Dame. Because part of the theology and ethic of Notre Dame University is that it welcomes the contributions of people from all backgrounds. Look, if you get into a car accident in the city of Chicago, you get picked up by an ambulance, you're likely to be taken to Rush Presbyterian Hospital, University of Chicago Hospital started by Baptists, Northwestern Memorial Hospital started by Methodists, Swedish Covenant Hospital started by the Swedish Covenant Christian community, Loyola University Medical Center started by Catholics. None of these health institutions turn away people who are not of their faith community. All of them were started by particular faith communities. 7 of the 8 Ivy League schools started by religious communities. 119 Methodist universities in the United States. Let me give you some interesting examples of those. USC, started by Methodists. Syracuse, started by Methodists. Our civil society is driven largely by particular religious communities, almost none of which turn away people who are not from their own background. You want to know why when you go to Louisville, Kentucky, that there's a lot of West African Muslims there, or when you go to Minnesota, there's a lot of Somali Muslims there, refugees? Because Lutheran social services, which are strong in those places, resettle refugees from other religions. I'll just state the obvious. The Baptists who started the University of Chicago didn't just create a university for Baptists. The Catholics who started Loyola didn't just create a university for Catholics. The Methodists who started USC didn't just create a university for Methodists. They created institutions based on their own particular inspiration that serve the public good. It's part of the genius of America, right? We frequently talk about the American promise being giving rights to different communities. We talk about rights all the time, and rights are very, very important. But really, the American genius is that when different communities are given their dignity and their rights, they will return the favor a thousandfold by contributing to their society. By building institutions, schools, social service agencies, hospitals that serve the public good. A huge part of America's genius, and also a major principle of pluralism, because it sends the signal that when we do something as Lutherans, as evangelicals, as Catholics, as Muslims, as Jews, we're not just doing it for ourselves. We are expressing a Jewish ethic that says serve others. Which, incidentally, was one of the reasons I was so sad about the treatment of Cordoba House, because it was the first major Muslim institution, as far as I could tell, that was focused externally and not internally, whose primary purpose wasn't a place for Muslims to pray or study or get married or have funerals, which is what religious communities first do. They build the private institutions of their own community. Its primary purpose was to serve the broader neighborhood. That's why it had an art center. That's why it had a culinary institute. That's why it had gymnasium space. That's why it had a swimming pool, right? And so I was thinking to myself, finally, our community has reached a state of maturity such that it's building institutions that serve others, expressing the Muslim ethic, not by saying we need to look internally and only cultivate Muslim identity, but expressing the Muslim ethic that says we have to serve externally, maslaha, the common good, mercy, rahma, right? And I was so proud of this. And so to watch it get slapped down and called a terrorist command center, like I said, I felt like I'd entered the Twilight Zone. Part 4 of American pluralism. It's the most American thing you can do is stand up for people who are not like you. And you see it over and over and over again in the American tradition. I want to tell a couple of stories about this. So even before America was a nation in the 1650s, when Peter Stuyvesant was a governor general of what was then called New Amsterdam, now it's called New York City, he creates an edict banning Quaker prayer meetings. He says that Quakers are rabble rousers and seducers of the people. Has anybody here ever been to a Quaker prayer meeting? Yeah. They don't even talk, you know, at these prayer. I would go when I was a student at Oxford and sit in silence for an hour in the morning, very moved by that, right? But I was like, rabble rousers, really? You know, something much deeper must be going on then, because I'm not getting it. In any case, people are beaten, you know, people are threatened. And a group of people in a little hamlet called Flushing, which is now maybe the most diverse area and, of course, the borough of Queens in New York City, gather together. A couple of them are minor officials. Most of them are just ordinary folks. And they create something that's called the Flushing Remonstrance. Google it. It's this really, really beautiful document that, you know, scholars say is the first stake in the ground in the land that would become called America for religious freedom. But really, it's the first stake in the ground for something that I think is much more beautiful than a legal doctrine. As important as religious freedom is, it's effectively a legal doctrine, right? The language in this document is, whoever comes to us with love, be he Jew, Quaker, Turk, or Egyptian, we are called to return love unto him. We are committed to seeing the light of God in all, as we are all children of the same God. There's some Theosophical Society themes in this document. It's more a document that seems to me like what Martin Luther King Jr. would call in 1956, the beloved community. None of the people who wrote that was Quaker. By the way, they presented it to Governor General Stuyvesant, who banishes a couple of them, throws a couple of them in jail for their efforts. Must be thinking to himself, why are you doing this? None of you has your personal freedom at stake. The most American thing you can do is stand up for someone who's not like you. I'll tell you a couple of personal stories, and then I'll end, and we'll have some Q&A and some comments. So after I met a guy named John Tateshi. I write about him in the book. He was the head of the Japanese American Citizens League. In the 1980s, he played a crucial 70s and 80s. He played a crucial role in the reparations movement for Japanese vis-a-vis their experience in the internment camps. He tells me that one of his earliest memories, he's 5 or 6 years old, was leaving an internment camp when the camps were finally shut down at the end of World War II. And his dad holds him by the shoulders and says, John, don't ever forget this moment. And don't let your country forget it, because America is too good for what it did to us. And on September 11, 2001, when John was driving south on I-5 out of his home in Seattle, going to a meeting deeper south in Washington State, he turned on the radio and he hears the news of the plane flying into the World Trade Center, and then the second plane. And he starts flipping the radio dial and he starts hearing the talk of, this is Muslims, this must be Muslims, this is Muslims, we're going to get them wherever they are, we'll get them in our own neighborhoods if we need to. And John starts to hear echoes in that language of the talk that paved the way to the internment camps in the 1940s. And he turned his car around and he called his assistant and he said, cancel all my meetings for the next 2 weeks and call every regional director of the organization of the Japanese American Citizens League and tell them, there is a message from the president. The focus of our organization for the foreseeable future is partnering with and defending American Muslims. And my throat got tight hearing this, you know, and I said, John, why'd you do this? You know, I'm like, you got enough worries, right? He's like, he said, there were people in California, in the west of America, where most of we Japanese lived in the early 20th century, who spoke up for us. And as we were being dragged away to the internment camps, said, we'll protect your farms. We'll protect your homes. He said, when I was a kid, I had this sense that if there were more of those people, the internment camps would never have happened. And so when I had a chance, I was going to be one of those people. The most American thing you can do is stand up for people who are not like you. Right? So a core theme of Sacred Ground is the idea that a major dynamic in American history is the forces of prejudice, which have been loud and powerful at various times in America, you know, from the anti-Semitic forces in the 18th century to the anti-Catholic forces and during the Know Nothing Party, and of course, racist forces throughout. But the reason that they have never won the day is because the forces of pluralism have engaged them and defeated them. And the reason I walk through the four pillars of pluralism in America, the vision of the founders, the response of African Americans to their marginalization, the fact that you can build an institution in this nation inspired by your own particular identity that serves the broader public good, and the importance of standing up for people who are not like you, is that this generation needs our own forces of pluralism. Pluralism doesn't fall from the sky. It doesn't rise from the ground, right? Bridges don't magically appear. People build bridges. People enact and enhance pluralism. What does it mean for us to be those people in this generation? To give voice to that, to create the spaces and the activities where people from different backgrounds can come together, build that respect, build those relationships, cultivate that cooperation for the common good. What Sacred Ground really is it's not just a history lesson about America. It's a call to action. It's a call to us as interfaith leaders to write the next chapter in the glorious story of American pluralism. I want to end with this story, a very personal story for me. So if there's a hero in the book Sacred Ground, it's the mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg. And he was probably the most prominent public voice in favor of Cordoba House or the Ground Zero Mosque, right? And at great risk to himself, at great risk to whatever future political aspirations he might have had. I have a good friend named Fatima Shama, a Brazilian-Palestinian Muslim, only in America, right? Do you grow up speaking Portuguese, Arabic, Spanish, and English, going to the same school that Sonia Sotomayor graduated from and then becoming a more serious Muslim in college. She's a great story. She's one of Bloomberg's commissioners in his cabinet, the commissioner for immigrant affairs. And she would give me kind of the insight that was going on in City Hall during this time. She said basically the hate mail about Bloomberg's stand in favor of the Ground Zero Mosque was like up to her waist. And people writing things like, you know, don't expect to count on either my vote or my financial contribution for your presidential race. You have just lost it, right? Because Bloomberg's support for Cordoba House wasn't a hide behind the Constitution. You know, the courts will allow this because of the First Amendment, which is what a lot of politicians were saying. It was a full-throated, I want this institution in my city support. And incidentally, City Hall is about three blocks from where the Ground Zero Mosque was meant to be. So when I went to see Fatima and the mayor, and I'll tell you about that in a moment, I literally walked by three blocks away and I thought to myself, huh, so this is where it was supposed to be. Really interesting, right? Mayor did that too. He would walk by and say, this is where it's supposed to be. Right? So mayor gives two major speeches, front page of the New York Times type speeches in favor of Cordoba House. Speeches that sound not unlike the Flushing Remonstrance, actually. Not just articulating the legal doctrine of religious freedom, but saying, I want this institution in this neighborhood. It will contribute to the vitality of this city, right? He sees it as a important civic contribution to America. Fatima told me that his speechwriters would write the first draft of the speech and he would say, it's not strong enough. And they'd write a second draft and he'd say, it's not strong enough. And he would say, do you not get it? This is a signature initiative for me. I'm not shy about this, right? I remember seeing the video of him speaking in front of the Statue of Liberty, and he he tears up as he's giving this speech in favor of this mosque. And I thought to myself, you know, who knew that that billionaire had tear ducts, you know? But he was getting really emotional about this. And because of my friendship with Fatima, I got 15 minutes with the mayor, not long, about 4 months ago. And I brought him a copy of the book. I said, you know, if there's a hero in this book, it's you, Mr. Bloomberg. I said, you know, tell me, why'd you do this? Why'd you do this? And he said, and I'm going to end with this little story. He said, you know, my dad was a bookkeeper. And his best year, he made $11,000. Right? This is a master of the masters of the universe. Grows up in a house where his dad makes $11,000 a year in his best year. They try to buy a house in the little suburb outside of Boston called Medford, Massachusetts. And they can't do it. Want to know why? Because they're Jewish. They have to have their Christian lawyer purchase the house for them and sell it back to them under the table. Right? And Bloomberg said to me, hey, I thought to myself, you know, I was a kid at the time, if I ever have the chance to build a country where nobody experiences what I experienced, I'm going to do it. He said, it is the easiest decision I ever made. Is the easiest decision I ever made. It's the most right thing that I did as mayor. His dad would give $50-$100 a year to the NAACP. And as he was growing up, he was like, you know, Dad, that's real money for us. That's like 3 or 4 meals out for this family. Why are you doing that? And Bloomberg looked me in the eye and he said, my dad said to me, don't you get it, Michael? Their struggle is our struggle. That's an interfaith leader. That's why we have pluralism in America, and we need more of it. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Ibu, for a moving call to action. You've agreed to have some questions and some comments.
Yeah, why don't we take about 10 minutes of questions? I'm always careful with people's time, but so we'll take about 10 minutes of questions. And
so I'm sure, having heard Ibu speak, I should say just 2 days ago, I was up in Madison, Wisconsin with the Dalai Lama, and he spoke, and he talked about how prayer is a wonderful thing, and a lot of us are very addicted to prayer. But he said that prayer is great, but action is better. And what Ibu has been talking about is actually doing tonight. It's something that actually, you know, I don't want to take any of the floor, but to me it's very interesting because actually having you talk about out in California when the Japanese were interred, and you know my father and my parents were there, and they were house-sitting for some of the Japanese people who had their possessions taken away until they got back. And so a lot of these things kind of ring bells for me.
Right. It's just personal stuff for a lot of us.
Yeah. Anyway, you heard it. Some thoughts?
Yes. I so appreciate the way you put together your books with history and civics and government and then the personal. This most recent book, you ended talking about children, which you didn't get to touch on yet. I'm one who feels that the children shall lead us. And I love a few of your stories that you tell in your book. Others might appreciate hearing just a little bit. And I'm wondering, part two, if anyone is kind of going in that direction with any books that you know of that are especially good for encouraging children to learn.
Right. Well, thank you for that. So I end the book with a chapter on my son Zaid, and you're right, and it starts with my wife calling me and saying, you know, my Spanish is rusty, but I do believe that Zaid is saying the Lord's Prayer in Spanish, and we thought to ourselves, wow, you know, our Brazilian Catholic, our Colombian Catholic nanny, you know, is working double time, you know. But it's this insight of of, we're all born into a situation of religious pluralism now. We're all born into a situation where there are multiple influences and intimations of different traditions from secular humanism to Hinduism all around us. And the question, I think, is how do we deepen our roots and expand our wings at the same time? And it's a question that my one of my mentors, Brother Wayne Teasdale, who I write about in my first book, Acts of Faith, would talk about a lot, deepening our roots and expanding our wings. And so I'll tell one more funny story about Zaid. My family has great respect for Catholic education, as many people who trace their heritage back to the Indian subcontinent do. And so we looked for Catholic preschools for our sons. And so Zaid went to a Catholic school for preschool. So my wife's name is Shanaz, which means pride of the king. And jokingly, I say to Zaid one day, you know, so Zaid, sweetie, mommy's name means pride of the king. Who's the king? I expect him to say, daddy's the king. He's five, right? I mean, you know what he says? He puts on his very best, daddy, you're a Dumbo voice. And he's like, daddy, Jesus is the king. And I'm like, okay, somebody's been listening really well in Catholic school, you know? But this is part of the beauty and the richness of growing up with religious diversity. It means that there are additional complexities to nurturing children in the faith tradition of a home. And there are additional opportunities, because all of a sudden, all of the relational dimensions of Islam, right, the lines like God made us different nations and tribes that we may come to know one another, those dimensions are so much more real to my son in early 21st century America than they might have been hundreds of years ago in a more homogenous area. So I write about that in the final chapter, and I'm glad you made it that far in the book. It's probably my favorite chapter of the book. It's Zaid's favorite chapter too. When his friends like come over with comic books, he proudly sits down with that and he starts reading from his own chapter. My son is six, so precocious. Desmond Tutu has a beautiful children's book out called, I think, All God's Children or God's Rainbow Tribe, which is about kind of a spiritual view on human diversity, which I would commend to you if you're interested in more writing like this.
Now, the question online is, for organizations such as the Theosophical Society, do you have any sort of thought as far as what could be done to address the sorts of issues you've been talking about?
Well, I think people and organizations ought to do what they do well, right? So if anybody said, you know, cooking was the only route to world peace, I'd be like, I'm out, you know? Part of what you have done well for many generations is illuminate the spiritual wisdom in different traditions. And I thank you for that. And I would just say, keep on doing that, right? So part of what we do well at Interfaith Youth Corps is we train young people to be interfaith leaders. That's our particular part of this challenge. And I think every person and every organization ought to do what it does well.
Is religious pluralism itself a religion?
I don't think so.
But this must be one of the things you struggle with all. Probably on a personal level and with the organization.
Yeah.
Meaning how does one deepen one's own faith, particular faith stance, at the same time fostering better, more understanding of other religions? I mean, it's something in other words, I, as an individual, want to give myself, commit myself only to that which I believe is true, mm-hmm. ultimately true. But then I know that, you know, the person who's a Buddhist or a Muslim or whatever feels like he or she is doing the same thing. And in a sense, we can end up feeling that, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, John Hick kind of talk, that what we've ended up doing is we have another religion which selects from various religious traditions as being the only things which
right.
are authentic.
So that doesn't happen to be my view, but it is one view. What I mean by that is what I would call kind of a spiritually universalist view, is one view of kind of a metaphysical religious pluralism. I don't happen to hold that, right? I hold something a little different, which is that each tradition has its own theology of interfaith cooperation, and that what one way to think about this is to ask oneself the question, why, as a Christian, should I be in positive relationship with Jews?
What is it in each tradition?
That's right.
That foster this kind of
belief? And let me be clear, is that you know, I quote this in Sacred Ground, but I quote from Wilford Cantwell Smith, the great line that he says, my ultimate aim is not to get you to understand Islam and Buddhism, it's to get you to understand Muslims and Buddhists. So our endeavor is not about Islam and Buddhism, it's about Muslims and Buddhists, which is to say that as a Muslim or as a Buddhist, you don't have to believe in Islam, you just have to have a positive relationship with Muslims. And you have to have a sense of the tradition that animates and inspires them.